I think we'll get going. Good morning. Welcome to the Property and Local Sales Tax Division. And this is our first meeting. Pleased to have all of you here. We do have a lot of freshman members on the committee, so we'll want to have a chance to go around and introduce ourselves. And there are certainly people that we, even I don't know, and I've been around a while, here and there, that is. And we do, though, I believe, have some good local government experience in our freshman members. And I think that'll be an asset to our committee. My name's Linda Runbeck. I'll be chairing the committee. And I think what we'll do is maybe start with members. We'll do that? Yeah. Okay. Do you want to introduce yourself, Bob? We'll go around and tell us, where you're from. And I would like to hear if you've been on local government and what role you've played.
Sure. That's easy. No. The answer is no. Okay. My name is Bob Barrett. I am a freshman representative representing Chisago County. Cities in North Branch, Chisago City, Wyoming, Lindstrom, Taylor's Falls, Rush City. I come from the private sector, from a drug and alcohol treatment center and a publisher of materials related to drug and alcohol addiction. So I don't have any local government experience, but I'm very interested in helping solve, as we all are, the local property tax dilemma, both for individuals and for businesses. We have a lot of businesses in our county who aren't doing very well, and I'm in contact with a lot of these people who are just struggling with a high increase in property taxes. In the most recent year, they just got their statement and, quite frankly, are mad as hell because they got a 8%, 9% increase when they're not doing very well. So I'm here to help them as well as the individuals in my county. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is John Benson. I represent House District 43B, which is Minnetonka and part of Plymouth. This is my third term. I have not served on the tax committee or tax division before, mostly education committees. That was my career. I spent 30-some years teaching in Edina High School before. And so I'm interested in this issue very much, like Representative Barrett here, because my concern is for the increasing property tax burden that not only residential taxpayers pay, but also small business. And I'm hopeful that we can stop the continuous slide that's been going on for the last two or three sessions of offloading state government responsibilities onto local taxpayers. So that's why I'm interested in being on the committee, and thank you.
Thank you. Senator?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Doug Wardlow. I represent District 38B, the eastern half, basically, of Eagan. I don't have any experience on local government, but as an attorney, I represent property owners. I spent quite a bit of time representing property owners before or against local governments in eminent domain actions, and also before boards like the Minneapolis Heritage Preservation Commission. So I have some experience dealing with local governments. Like Representatives Benson and Barrett, I'm very concerned about the increasing burden of property taxes, not only in individuals and residential in their homes, but also the stifling effects of commercial and industrial property taxes on our state's job creators.
Thanks. Representative Doubt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kurt Doubt. I represent District 17A, which is almost all of Isani County, a little sliver of Anoka County, and a portion of Chisago County. I have spent 6 years as a township supervisor, and then followed by 6 years as a county commissioner in Isani County. So in case you're doing the math in your head, I started that when I was 12. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lemire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Lemire. I'm from Little Falls. I represent District 12B, which consists of mostly Morrison and parts of Crow Wing County. I served 4 years on the Little Falls City Council and 2 years as council president.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Good morning. I must have luck of the Irish. I got here just in time.
Phew. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm a new freshman, and I come from Delano. I represent Wright County. I replaced Tom Emmer's seat. Prior to that, I was the mayor of Delano for 4 years and city council member for 10. father of three boys and a photographer. I have a portrait studio. My wife and I run a portrait studio in down beautiful, historic downtown Delano.
All right.
So, thank you.
Representative Crawford is our vice chair of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Roger Crawford. I'm a freshman from Mora, small business owner. I have local government experience like Joe. I served on the Mora City Council for 5 years. I was mayor for 4 years, and also was on the county board when I got elected to this position. We just had a what we used to call a truth and taxation meeting on December 30th before I resigned. So we had a very interesting meeting that night with citizens. So, you know, we in those positions, of course, you get very close to the people and how they're feeling and what they're thinking about property taxes. So great to be here.
And I'm Linda Runbeck. I hail from the lovely city of Circle Pines. Actually, I'm a retread. I was in the legislature in the 90s, both in the Senate and then previous to that in the House. And just a word about my city. Actually, I served on the city council of Circle Pines. And they now, for 2 years, have lived within their means. I'm very proud of them. They have not raised the levy, and they have actually cut their budget and suffered a lot of LGA cuts. So got to give them credit. They, I think they're doing the responsible thing. And over to Diane. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. I'm Representative Diane Loeffler from Northeast Minneapolis. And while this is, I'm starting my fourth term, this is my first elected office. Although I can say in my career as a budget and policy analyst, I've worked for state government, a city, a school district, and a county. So I have a broad sense of local government services and how we play a partnership role in that. I like to say I represent the 13 neighborhoods in Northeast Minneapolis, and I've had someone recently say, well, ask, what's a neighborhood? And it's like a small town. It's probably the least incorporated association of people working together. They mine range from 700 to almost 3,000 residents. They have their own little main streets. They have their neighborhood associations that function a lot like a township, trying to do neighborhood or neighbor-to-neighbor problem solving. And those neighbors are concerned about the property tax levels that they've endured of late.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Paul Marquardt. This is my sixth term. Represent all or parts of four counties along the Red River Valley, Clay County, Wilkin County, Becker County, and Traverse County. I was mayor in Dilworth for 11 years, and like almost every member here on the committee, talking about concern for property taxes, that's certainly a huge concern for me as we've kind of balanced the budgets on the back of property taxpayers the last several years. So hopefully we can stop that tide. But it's congratulations, Madam Chair, and it's
Thank
always
you.
Great to be on this committee.
Thank you. Representative Conan. Is it Conan?
Okay. Yes, that's right, Madam Chair. Thank you. Yeah. Madam Chair and committee members, this is my fifth year in the House. I represent, fifth term in the House of Representatives. I represent District 20B, which includes Renville County, half of Yellow Medicine County, and Chippewa County. Most of my life, I was a dairy farmer for 27 years, actually, so that's the background I come from. Although I haven't been elected to a local unit of government office myself, my father is a county commissioner, and I have a brother who was a township officer and a mayor in Clary City, so I sure hear from them about local government issues. Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair and members, it's good to be here, and thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lencheski, we have your expertise to draw on. That'll be great.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members. It's really great to be here this year, and I look forward to working with you and everyone, and I think it'll be an exciting yet challenging session. Yeah. I represent Bloomington, a portion of Bloomington, and it's always so interesting to listen to rural members who represent multiple counties and dozens of cities. I represent a part of one city, just a part, Bloomington, and I'm really delighted to be here. And and I was a city council member for a couple terms and a planning commissioner, and so a lot of local government experience. Thank you.
And we're doing introductions?
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Mahoney. I represent the northeast corner of the city of St. Paul. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I see we have an additional member here.
Yeah, Representative Bob Detmer. It's my third term, second term on the property tax committee, and I represent northern Washington County and eastern Anoka County, seven communities, Forest Lake, Scandia, Columbus, Lionel Lakes, Linwood, Centerville, and Hugo, and Columbus. And prior to coming and serving in the legislature, I was an educator, teacher, and coach for 34 years. So a pleasure to be working here.
Good to have you here, neighbor. He's my neighbor. Let's introduce the committee staff, starting over here with Abigail.
Good morning. My name is Abigail Johnson. I am the GOP researcher. Happy to be here. I'm working, obviously, with this committee and also with Education Finance.
I'm Anna Forney. I'll be the committee legislative assistant for this committee.
And you're from?
I'm from Fergus Falls, Minnesota.
Okay.
Bobby Patrick. I'm the CA for this committee and taxes. I see many of you there as well. I'm originally from Fairmont, but now I live in downtown Minneapolis.
And I apologize. I am actually originally from Iowa. Please don't hold it against me. I am making up for it by now living in Representative Runbeck's district.
All righty. And let's introduce the research staff. And they've been introduced previously at the tax committee meetings as our best friends. And they really are. I mean, these folks have immense and substantial knowledge and help guide us through this very intricate and complicated system. But we'll start with Pat.
My name's Pat Dalton. I'm with House Research, and I cover the areas of local government aids and levy limits.
Great. Steve?
Good morning, members of the division. I'm Steve Hines with House Research, and I cover I guess pretty much most property tax related things, but especially data related things, property tax simulations, and also county aid, the county program aids and county aid programs, and the market value credit program. And I'll be, Karen Baker is not with, she's out with medical leave right now, but she would normally be here, so I'll be covering a lot of the things she would normally cover, which is kind of more the administrative things of property taxes.
Thank you.
Good morning, members. My name is Kathy Schill, and I'm the fiscal analyst for this committee. So anything having to do with revenue estimates, fiscal notes, local impact notes, spreadsheet analysis, basically keeping us along with the bottom line if we get targets, things like that. And if you have questions, please feel free.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. And Mr. Michael?
I'm Joel Michael, also from House Research. I normally don't work much on property tax issues, but if Karen Baker's absence during medical leave, I'll be filling in along with Steve for her. I'll be doing all of the mining taxes to the extent you want to get into those issues, and some of the property administration and other issues related to property taxes that Steve can cover.
And thank you. Ms. Manzi?
Dina Manzi, also in House Research. My primary area is individual income tax, so you won't see me that much in this committee, but I also work on property tax refunds for homeowners and renters, and also the special property tax refund, which is sometimes called charging.
Thank you. And Ms. Templin? Thank you. And I see we have a few more staffers for the committee. Can you ladies introduce yourselves, please? Our pages.
My name is Angela McDonald. I will be working on this community property tax as well as redistricting and ways and means.
Great.
And my name is Megan Duke. I have this committee, and I'll be working also with K-12 Finance. I'm originally from Lindstrom, but now I live in Forest Lake.
Great. Thank you. And we have Sasha, please.
I'm Sasha Burke, and I'll be the researcher for property taxes.
And I don't know if we officially called the meeting to order, but the meeting of the Property Tax and Sales Tax Division is now in order. And we're going to begin with overviews, and certainly because of the large number of freshman members, I think this will all be very, very valuable. But certainly every time we go through it ourselves, you know, we probably pick up something new. So it's very useful. And I'm just going to start with one reference here. If you read your Star Tribune on Sunday and their main editorial, I think they've kind of laid out one of the challenges that we have, and that is a chief aim of tax reform this session should be to slow down the property tax escalator for businesses and homeowners alike. So I think they captured it extremely well, and hopefully that as a committee we'll be able to pull that off. And I think it's all ideas welcome, and we're going to have a fun year. But why don't you proceed then? Is it Mr. Hines initially or Ms. Schill?
Good morning, members. I'll be starting off, or at least the lead off to our conversation today. My name is Kathy Schill. I'm the fiscal analyst of this committee, and we'll be working with two different documents. First of all, you have in your packet a PowerPoint presentation, which is about 40 slides, 20 pages long. And the second document is a collection of reference documents, short subjects that's about 43 pages long. And it will provide a heck of a lot more detail as we proceed through today's presentation. There is a third document that Mr. Patrick has. And, oh, by the way, we did this presentation for the tax committee, and we did it quickly because we were given a certain amount of time. And we're doing the same presentation for this committee today, but we are going to take more time going through it. And so there are some slides that we will be doing today, some slides we will be doing next week in more detail. And when we get to that area, we'll let you know what it is. But we wanted to make sure that we had ample time for questions and to help better offer assistance and education about property tax issues. The third document is just for reference, and it's for basically the new members. It's kind of a revisit to some of the work that we did with the property tax working group, and I did a presentation before them on November 18th, and I selected some slides there for your benefit, and it's basically talking about property tax systems in general, and then also identifying some attributes of Minnesota's property tax system in specific. In Minnesota, the governance of property taxes is a shared responsibility between state and local governments. While property taxes are the mainstay of local government finances, Minnesota's property tax system is highly centralized at the state level. State law controls a number of system features, which we will cover today, more specifically in the state-operated kinds of programs. And so you'll see different ones of us taking our turns with different areas of the property tax system. Moving to slide two, let's take a look at state and local taxes in Minnesota. In fiscal 2011, tax revenues are expected to reach $25.2 billion. As shown by the pie chart, property taxes bring in the most revenues, yielding about $8.1 billion, or 32.3% of the total. Next are individual income taxes with almost $7.3 billion, or 28.9%. Statewide sales taxes are third with $5.3 billion, or 21%. And then other state taxes, including corporate franchise tax, gas tax, excise taxes, and other taxes, are at $4 billion, or about 16.1%. Of this $25.2 billion in tax collections, the split between state and local tax revenues is about $17.4 billion to $7.8 billion, or about 2.2 to 1. Moving to slide number three, a 10-year comparison of the big three, income, sales, and property taxes. The bar graph here gives a 10-year comparison of those big three taxes for fiscals 2001, 2006, and fiscal year 2011. Note how the sales tax grew from 2001 to 06 and then slightly declined in fiscal 11, that the income tax dipped slightly from fiscal 01 to 06 but then rebounded in fiscal 11, and that the property tax shows little change between fiscal 01 and 06 but then spiked for fiscal 11. Of the $25.2 billion in state and local tax collections for fiscal 11, the big three taxes, sales, individual income, and property, accounted for 82.2% of the total. In fiscal 01, these accounted for about 85% of the state and local tax collections. And now for the discussion on property tax administration.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. And Mr. Hines?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next slide pertains to sort of the who are the main actors in the property tax system. And, of course, as with all of this, most of you have some familiarity with this, but maybe this fills in some of the gaps. This slide is covered in more detail on page 6 of the longer handout. And especially because we're trying to take this a little more in-depth today than we did in full committee Thursday, I'm going to be referring maybe to the longer document more often. So hopefully that won't be overwhelming. But there's, at any rate, page 6 has a more fuller description. But most of you know we kind of always, you think of the assessor as the first actor you think of when you think of property taxes. The assessor job is to value property, place a value on the property, determine its classification, which is very critical in Minnesota's highly classified system, and send out valuation notices. The county auditor, you see down in the chart a little lower, is the one that actually determines the tax rates and calculates the tax on individual for individual tax statements for both the truth in taxation statement and the actual property tax statement. As most of you I know are aware, in Minnesota you kind of get two property tax statements, one in the fall telling you what property taxes are going to be if nothing changes, and then the final one in the spring, which is what they actually are. In a lot of counties, some of these county offices have been merged, but formally we still address them in statute as the assessor's jobs, the auditor's jobs, and then the county treasurer down at the bottom is the one that actually mails the statements out and collects the payments from taxpayers, distributes the payments to the local governments. The taxing districts have an important role to play. They have to determine what their levy is, the amount of revenue they intend to raise from the property tax. And that is what their decision is, how much are they going to levy, which they forward to the county auditor, who then makes it all work out. It gets a tax rate that will yield to that level of tax collections. Kind of going on back to the individual ownership side, on the left side of the chart there we've just sort of shown a step, the boards of appeal and equalization. It's not always, as many of you are aware, just an issue of the assessor determining the value. A lot of times the taxpayer doesn't necessarily agree with that assessment, and there are a number of steps they can take to appeal that assessment. There's a three-step process which involves going to the local board of review. Then if that's not a successful outcome, going to the county board of appeal, and then ultimately the tax court. Alternatively, you can go directly to the tax court. And this is laid out in more full detail on page 6. The next page slide refers to the timeline of the property tax system. And this can be a confusing concept because it basically, and again, I'm going to say that page 7 of the longer handout is going to be what I may be more focused on here. That shows quite clearly that each year of property tax collections actually takes two full calendar years for that cycle to run, starting with, as you can see from that chart, say for taxes payable in 2011, which is the left-hand column of the chart, that all process really begins on January of 2010 when the assessment is actually made. That's the formal date at which the property is supposed to be valued as of January of 2010 for taxes payable in 2011. And so you see that during the 2010 there's the assessment, evaluation notices mailed, the boards of appeal, boards of review, et cetera, all taking place in the first half of 2010. Then in July, we start getting into the other actors. The Department of Revenue notifies local governments of the amount of state aid. They have to set their levies in the fall. Their truth and taxation levies are set in the early part of the fall. Truth and taxation notice is mailed. And the final budget is set December of 2010. So all of that's occurred in 2010 for payable 11. Then in 2011, you have a whole another set of steps involving actually finalized levies, computing tax rates, mailing statements, collecting the taxes. So all in all, the cycle runs 2 years. And as you can see from the chart, in any given time point in time, the property tax administrators are sort of thinking about two different years' worth of taxes, because the pay 2012 is going on in 2011, as is the pay 2011. So it's useful to keep in mind that there's a long time frame to really collect the year's worth of property taxes, and that leads to some problems of why maybe the laws we make take a while to take effect in the property tax.
Mr. Hines, could I interrupt a second? Just going back to the Board of Equalization, I mean, are you hearing, I mean, just given the issues now with assessments and so on, are we experiencing tremendous workloads, back sort of clogging of our court system or the whole Board of Review process? Has that been overburdened in the last year or two?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware that it's particularly overburdened at this point. There certainly have been, we've been in this situation now for a number of years where values have been on the decline, which I think probably initially really led to lots of more cases of appeal as valuations sort of turned around from a normal, what we used to think of as normal, steady, some level of growth to a flattening out and even going down. But to be honest, I'm not that up on it. That's a question that Ms. Baker would have a little better handle on, who's not here.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And, of course, the Department of Revenue has people who oversee the assessment system, and at some point, if the committee wants to get into more detail, I'm sure they would be able to give you much more information on that.
Thank you. Mr. Hines.
Mm-hmm. The next slide is briefly discussing truth in taxation, and major changes were made in the truth in taxation law in 2010. As many of you probably know, the situation that we used to have with truth in taxation is truth in taxation consisted of a number of steps. The local governments have to set a levy in the fall, which ultimately leads to a set of and publish a notice in the paper saying what their levy was going to, the proposed levy would be. Administrators had to turn around a tax statement to get out to everybody, which occurs in early November, and then at least up until 2010, there was a hearing required for many jurisdictions to have their final hearing on setting their levy after these statements had come out. In 2010, we eliminated both the requirement that these truth in taxation preliminary levies be published in the newspaper and for this truth in taxation hearing that would occur after the statement. So now the truth in taxation process now consists primarily of, or exclusively of, these statements that have to get mailed out. And of course that, I think, is still the major piece of it. And that's the big workload for counties is getting these statements out. And the local governments still have to conduct have more obligations on them to have public hearings at a time on their levy when people can be there. Some requirements that they be in the evening, et cetera. But there's no longer this requirement. There has to be a single truth in taxation hearing and a budget set at that hearing or continuation. So that was all new to most of us that have been through the system, that this has just changed as of 2010. The next two slides are some of the basic terminology that you'll encounter in the property tax system, and this corresponds with page 9 of the longer document, but I'm just going to touch on the main sort of terminologies that we need to get comfortable with, those who aren't already. There's the concept of taxable market value. That's the basically the value that the assessor places on the property or that results from the various appeals processes. The assessor's value is really the estimated market value. In most cases, that's the same as taxable market value, but there can be some cases where the taxable value could be different. For instance, Green Acres program that I know many of you are familiar with results in the property having a taxable value that's different than its estimated market value. Taxable market value is the key step to getting into the computations. A property's net tax capacity is its taxable market value times the class rate, and the class rate is a function of what the classification
is. Mr. Hines, I think we have a question. Representative Warlow.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Hines,
yes.
Could you talk maybe a little bit about the method evaluation that the assessor will generally use to assess the taxable market value or the estimated market value?
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, the idea of the assessment system is to capture the value of the property in the marketplace. And that's the really the goal of always is to capture this estimated market value. So by and large, the system that the assessor uses is based on sales data of arm's length transaction properties that are of similar to the property in question. And so sales data is the driving force behind the assessment system for most cases. When you get into properties that are more unique, that don't lend themselves as easily to a sales comparison, that's when it gets a little more complicated, and I don't profess to be a complete expert on assessment by any means, but especially when you get into commercial industrial properties that are not just renting out a space, which then you can just look at the rental price, you get into the business itself, then they go to an analysis of sales returns on on the business entity itself, on the nature, the orientation of the business and its income. And that's a much more complicated process. We require different certification levels for assessors if they're going to get into commercial properties. And that's in a nutshell.
Representative Wardlow?
Thank you.
Mr. Hines?
I should say, Madam Chair and members, that I'm glad you've been asking some questions. You should certainly feel free to ask as many as you want because we're here to help you understand things, and we don't need to get through any specific agenda. It's more important to get to your questions, so by all means, jump in. Another important concept is the concept of a levy, and we talk about levies a lot, but the real... The definition of the levy is just the amount. The levy is something that's set by each taxing jurisdiction, and the levy is the amount of dollars that the jurisdiction intends to receive from the property tax system. In some cases, that's completely the jurisdiction's own decision. In other cases, the jurisdiction might have some limit on how much it can levy that's imposed by the state, and. But either way, they have to ultimately certify a levy that tells the county auditor this is the amount of money we need to take in, and the county auditor is the one who figures out the tax rate that makes it all work out. And the way they make that out is by dividing. It's a simple case of dividing the levy by the total tax capacity, the tax base, really, of the community or of the jurisdiction itself. Kind of focusing more on individual property taxpayers, the gross property tax is the amount of tax that you get by just taking each property's tax capacity or its tax base and multiplying it by the tax rate of each of the jurisdictions that it owes property taxes to. And then the net property tax is the gross tax minus any credits that the property might get. And homesteads and agricultural properties are the primary ones that are eligible to receive some credits that might reduce their gross property tax. There are a few more terms on page 9 that you might want to take a look at on your own later. So I guess before I move on to slide 9, I would like to just take you to page 10 of the longer document very quickly, just run down how these sort of
terminologies actually come into play for a specific property. And so here, this is the property here, is a house valued at $200,000. The class rate of that, because it's determined by the assessor to be a residential homestead, it has a class rate of 1%. So its net tax capacity in step three is $2,000, the $200,000 times the 1%. Now, step four is looking at what is the total tax rate that applies to the property, and that is simply the result of summing the tax rates of each of the jurisdictions. In this hypothetical example, the county rate is 40%, et cetera. We get a total. Special districts, which we haven't addressed yet, I maybe just touch on those, are things like watershed districts, housing and redevelopment authorities, the Metropolitan Council. There are a number of those special taxing districts besides the city, county, school district that you're really familiar with. So in this case, we have a 95% total tax rate. We get a step five, we multiply the $2,000 from step three, the tax rate from step four, to get a gross tax of $1,900. And that isn't
just
really
the moment, Mr. Hines. Was there a question? Representative Barrett?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hines, just have a quick question about the difference between the residential and commercial property tax as it relates to the total levy.
Sure.
Situation in our county happened this year where the levy was zero, and a lot of the residential folks had a decline in property tax, and a lot of the business folks had a substantial increase in property tax. Obviously, all that relates to their portion of the total valuation in the county. The thoughts from the county board were that the state had some influence in how the commercial property values were increasing and the residential property values were decreasing. So do you have any thoughts on that? Is that to what extent does the state involve itself in that situation?
Mr. Hayes?
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, that's an excellent question and topic for us to get into a little bit. For the most part, the state doesn't have any direct authority over the valuation of an individual property, but the state does play a very important role and a very active role in overseeing what the counties do in their assessment process. And that's the primary mechanism is this device called the sales ratio study. Each year the state compiles data on all the sales that go on in the entire state and determines for each county, even for each jurisdiction below the county level, looks at the relationship between the sales data and the assessment data to see how good the assessment is in terms of being close to that market value. And the department has various means to cajole, perhaps, local assessors into bringing up their values. Typically, that's the case. The values are low, and will encourage them to be bringing them up. Including they can actually issue orders saying you have to. A state board order is issued at various times where they will actually issue an order saying, for instance, all the ag farm values in your county have to go up by X percent. That would be a typical type of a state board order. So the assessors are always very aware of these sales ratio study, the department's oversight, and try to avoid getting these orders, which is the state saying you've actually got to take this action. So, but the state never comes into an individual property and says you have to make a different change. And when I say never, there might be some examples where they can in some very limited cases. But by and large, that's how the system works. The state looks at the sales data, keeps sort of track of how everybody's doing, and issues these orders in certain cases. So in the case that you're referencing, it could be that the assessor was saying, I know that the state's looking at these sales and that last year my commercial value sales ratio was low, and so I've got to bring that up. That could be in a sense that the assessor is somewhat blaming the state for that, that possibly that's what's going on.
Sure. Representative Barrett, you have a follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Hines. Mm-hmm. So a quick conversation between me and the local assessor would gauge whether there's some state involvement in his duties to increase the commercial property tax base. That would be the result of me trying to follow up with a constituent of mine.
Madam Chair, President Barrett, I think that would be a good conversation to have, but you know, it really isn't a clear point at which you can say the state's making me do it or not, because the assessor can claim he's doing it to avoid having the state. You know, it's more of a continuum of the pressure that the state's bringing on them than an absolute, I suspect.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Hines, just a quick question. Of the 32% of the revenue collected, that portion is just commercial property tax, is that correct? And then the follow-up question, is that percentage 3% of the commercial property tax?
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, are you referring to the 32% on that slide early in the presentation?
That is correct.
Yes, that slide, the 32% property tax there, is a reference to all property taxes collected statewide on all types of property, not just commercial. This is homes and everything. And this is related to the total pie here is all property tax or all taxes collected by state and local governments in the state. So it's not just talking about commercial, and it's not just talking about the commercial industrial state tax, which I think is kind of what you're maybe is at the heart of your question. We will be getting into the state tax, state levy, the state portion of the property tax a little later on.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hines, thank you very much.
Mr. Hines.
Yes. Back to this page 10 handout, I'll just sort of finish through these calculations. We kind of were left off at step 5. Step 6 is the market value tax rate. This is a relatively new thing, although I guess that just refers to how long I've been here, because we really had the market value tax for quite some time now. But this is a tax rate that's usually most commonly is found by school districts, and it's basically the operating referendum for school districts is levied on a different basis than the rest of the tax system, on a market value basis, so we don't have the classification system at play. In this example, we've given a 0.15% rate of the market value tax. So that's in addition to the net tax capacity tax on line 7. That comes into play on this property. That's another $300. So in step 8, their total gross tax is $2,200. Step 9 is the market value homestead credit, and we're not talking about how that's calculated at this point. We'll get into that later. But in this case, that's $192. That's strictly a function of the value of the home, not the tax itself. And then the net tax on this home is $2,008. This is a typical example. These tax rates can vary around the state quite a bit, so there's no saying that a $200,000 home anywhere in the state is going to have this tax. But this would be a typical tax burden for a $200,000 home in the state. So now I'm on to the slide 9, and this talks about the actual class rates, which are the sort of the fundamental way in which we've created a system in the state where different types of property have different tax burdens. The residential homestead, the most common form of property in the state, has a class rate of 1% of value for the first 500,000 of value, a little higher rate, 1.25% above 500,000. Agricultural homesteads, which are we sometimes refer to as the most favored class because they have the lowest class rate, ag homesteads up to $1,140,000 worth of value have a class rate of 0.5%, 0.5% class rate, the first 1 million of an ag homestead. Ag non-homestead value has the same 1% class rate as the ag homestead, as the residential homestead, excuse me. And commercial industrial, you see, has the maybe the least favored classification rate, has the highest class rate of 1.5% on the first 150,000 of value, and 2% above $150,000. So This slide captures the full range of class rates. The lowest class rate we have is 0.5%, and the highest class rate is the 2%. We have many more classes of property than these four. The next slide shows a few of the other more common classes of property. Apartments have a class rate of 1.25. Residential non-homestead, which is a single unit, is same as homesteads, 1% first 500. Residential non-homestead duplexes and triplexes have a rate of 1.25%, so that's the same as the apartments. Seasonal recreational, another property class that we look at a lot around here, has the same class rate again as the homes at 1% for the first 500 and 1.25% above 500. Now, this slide doesn't show it, but on page 11 of that full handout, there's another sort of source of different types of tax burdens by different types of property, in that some of the classifications are subject to the state tax, and some classifications are subject to referendum levies, but others are not. So as Representative McDonald's question, I think, alluded to, you see that there's a state tax that only applies against commercial industrial property and seasonal recreational property, and that's so even though they're over and above their class rate, that results in some differential tax burdens. And then the referendum levies apply to most types of property, but not to ag land and not to seasonal recreational property. The next slide then shows that after sort of applying these different class rates and different rates, different tax rates that might apply, whether the state levy applies, whether the referendum levy applies, you can get pretty different tax burdens for the same value of property. So a property that's worth $200,000, we can get anything from a total tax burden of $790 in the case of an ag homestead, a little over $2,000 for a residential homestead or a seasonal recreation property,
sound system?
Phones.
Has a phone on?
If the power's on, it does it.
Better answer it.
We'll hope.
And then the
Mr. Hines.
The commercial industrial property in this case has a same $200,000 of value, has a tax rate or a tax of $5,000. So a range from all the way from 800 basically to 5,000 for a $200,000 property, because of the various class rates, classification rates, and tax rates that apply to those properties. The next slide now looks at the statewide totals, the relative relationship between the market value of that class of property and the amount of tax that's paid. And the biggest class, as you can see, is the residential homestead, which constitutes about a little over 50% of the total market value in the state, pays about 44% of the tax, of all the tax statewide. And agricultural classification, which is burgundy kind of on the colored slide, it shows the biggest difference in these two pie charts. You'll see that ag property constitutes 16% of the market value in the state, but pays about 7% of the tax in the state, and that's because of this low classification rate that we've given to ag homestead property. Commercial industrial is the poster child for the property that goes the other direction. You can see it only constitutes about 13% of the market value in the state, but pays about 31% of the total property tax burden in the state. And that's primarily because it has this highest class rate, which is generally 2%. In addition, it does pay the state general tax, which accounts for roughly a third, or a little less than a third, of the total burden on a commercial property. The flip side, I guess, of who pays property taxes is where does the money go? And that's shown on the next slide, where we see that of the $7.9 billion in property taxes collected in the state, you can see that counties are about 31%, so just a little bit under a third of the total amount goes to counties. Cities and school districts each get right around one quarter of that. The state general tax comes in at about 10% of that total. And then the last two small pieces are the townships, which are 2.5%, and special taxing districts, just under 4%. And the next slide then is a little sort of a little breakdown of the school district portion of the levy, and that's a portion that we don't generally talk about as much in this division, or haven't in the past, because there's a whole committee that works on school ed finance, as you know, but we like to be aware of it and pay attention to it. It does amount to account for about a quarter of the tax burden on property taxes in the state. And this sort of shows a number of different slices of where that school district, what purposes of the school levy there are. And there's some sort of nuances in how that money is collected. So the darker pieces, wedges of the pie, show the portions of the school levy that are voter approved. And as you can see, those two account for about 60% of the total school district levy is voter approved, versus only about 40% that's approved by the school board and not without voter input. Another way of looking at school districts is the, I alluded earlier to the referendum market value based levies. These are the levies where a dollar of commercial value pays the same as a dollar of residential value, so they're kind of a unique situation. That primarily is the school operating referendums, and you can see that those, this cross-hatched part of your of the chart is like 37% of the total is spread on that tax base versus 63% on the normal, regular tax base, the net tax capacity tax base. Another cut to look at it is the, you can look at the whole thing is the how much of school levies are operating versus capital, and it ends up being almost exactly 50-50 with the operating referendum, the equity and transition levies, and the other operating being the operating portions, and then the voter-approved debt, the capital, and the board-approved debt being the other 50%. So a couple different sort of things to keep in the back of your mind as we look at property taxes as to how that school levy is, what constitutes that school levy.
Mr. Hines? The referendum market value-based levies that are just board-approved, What's an example of something like that?
Madam Chair, that's
Mr. Hines.
That the only category there is the equity and transition levies, and I have to be honest that I don't have a very good handle on those themselves. You know, up in, when the referendum market value system first came in, the only levies that applied to was the referendums themselves. And then a number of years ago, the K-12 committee made some adjustments and created these new categories of equity and transition. And I think they kind of broke it out of the referendum levy. I think they don't apply to too many districts. Now, I'll take that back. I see another chart that says equity. A lot of them do get that. But I don't really understand those levies very well, to be honest.
Mr. Hines, and I we've got a couple new members that have arrived, and I know that Representative Dietrich and Representative Peterson, we'd like to introduce yourselves, but and also you have a question I know too, Ms. Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. When you were asking about non-voter approved levies, two came to mind for myself, and that is QCOMP. School boards have the ability to raise taxes in order to implement QCOMP. And I think that is about $90 per pupil in a lot of cases, right around there. And then we also have things like a safe school levies, where you don't—they don't need to go to the voters, but they can raise local property taxes for those purposes. So I just thought I would throw those two examples out there.
Sure, great.
Thank you.
Representative Dittrich, do you want to introduce yourself to the rest of the committee?
Sure.
Tell us, too, if you've been on a local government unit, served
Thank
as
you.
An elected official.
Thank you. My name is Denise Dittrich. I represent District 47A, which is all of Champlin and a portion of Coon Rapids. And I did serve on the Anoka-Hennepin School Board, which, in case you didn't know, is the largest school district in the state. and I could tell you more, but I won't. and I served on that board for 7 years.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Yeah, Representative Dietrich, you forgot to mention education land trusts as well. That's
one
of your favorite issues. You always manage to get in there. Brandon Peterson, the House District 49B, Coon Rapids and Southern Andover. I've never served on a local unit of government. Are we doing, if I could be any animal, I would be.
Okay. Representative Peterson. But thank you very much.
I want to be here.
All right, well, let's resume with Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, I would point out on page 15 of the longer document has a little bit more breakout of the school levies, and both of the levies that Representative Dietrich referred to are shown in that list, the QComp and the Safe Schools levy. However, in this pie chart that we talked about, those are part of the pie that's called the other operating. So they are net tax capacity-based levies, and they're not the referendum market value-based levies, which are just the equity and transition levies, those two categories. The next slide is talking about now the state general tax. We had a little bit of a discussion about that on page 16 of the longer document. There's a little bit of the history of that tax, or tax and the tax rate. Currently, that tax is at $800 million for calendar year 11. It increases annually by an inflationary index. Applies only to commercial, industrial, and seasonal recreational property. The shares are statutorily fixed at 95% of the total on commercial, industrial, and 5% on seasonal recreational. If you look at the chart on page 16 of the longer document that actually shows the tax rates, the tax rate for commercial industrial ends up being 49% for calendar year 11 versus only 19% for seasonal recreational. So it's more than twice, the rate is more than twice as high for the commercial industrial part than the seasonal recreational. And let's see. This state levy I was going to mention came into play in 2001. A major overhaul of the property tax system was undertaken, and that's when the class rate system that we have in place was primarily created, and the state levy came into being. And up to that point, there had not been a state. The state did not collect property taxes per se. So this state general tax is new as of 2001 session, so beginning in 2002, and that page 16 shows how that amount has grown from $592 million in its initial year up to $800 million this year.
Mr. Hines, yes. I have a question. What drives that number, and who makes that decision?
Madam Chair, the statute dictates that inflation is based on the implicit price deflator, which is a standard type of a price index that we use in a lot of measures around property taxes. It refers to the annual increase in cost of providing government services, and the Department of Revenue actually makes the calculation and each year notifies the counties of what the amount is, what the rate is.
All right, thank you.
And now I'm going to turn it back over to Ms. Schill for a while here.
Page 16 is blank on purpose. Page 17 will start the presentation of the major property tax relief programs. This includes who benefits and how much spending is forecasted for fiscal year 12. Of all the tax aids and credit spending, the top programs, local government aid, county program aid, market value credits, both kinds, residential, homestead, and agriculture, and property tax refunds, that includes homeowners and renters, comprise $1.5 billion, or 87% of the $1.7 billion in the FY 2012 budget for property taxes. So, and if this is just the brief overall, I will be providing at our next meeting an update of the catalog of budget activities, which will give spending detail and a quick blurb that will describe and reference each of the items. But so this table is meant to do the broad brush. You can see for local government aid spending is anticipated at $527 million, and the recipient, obviously, cities. Next is county program aid, anticipated at a level of $198 million, and that's obviously counties. To reiterate in the order Mr. Hines just presented, each of the equalization aids, that considerably less money goes there, as well as with disparity reduction aid. The disparity reduction aid goes to counties, towns, and special districts. The next page will continue on with credits. We have the homestead market value credit at $265 million, which goes to all local government jurisdictions, as well as the agricultural market value credit, considerably less at $24 million. And then the major refund programs, property tax refunds for homeowners at $318 million. These and property tax refunds go directly to individuals, and that's important to keep in the back of your mind. Property tax refunds for renters is estimated at $199 million, and then the special property tax refund, also known as the targeting refund, at $4 million. Now we'll turn to some more tax aids and credit spending histories for cities and counties in particular.
Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Ms. Dalton.
For the record, I'm again Pat Dalton with House Research. And we are going to take you through part of what the presentation we did for property taxes on AIDS, for the full tax committee on AIDS right now. But then we're going to go into detail on each of the individual programs and their formulas at the next property tax committee hearing. But we will give you one of the overviews, which might be interesting right now, given the bill that's going to be heard in tax mm-hmm. committee right after this, and that is the history
Ms. Dalton, I'm certain we're happy to know that there's still more detail to get through. I mean, if this isn't complicated enough. But go ahead, Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the issues, of course, in the last several years has been the difference between AIDS certified and AIDS and credits paid. And that's what we're going to talk a little bit about right now. And I can't seem to find my notes, so I'll do this off the top of my head. In the last essentially decade, there have been a number of cuts made to aids and credits, mainly as a result of budget, state budget problems. And as Mr. Hines had noted earlier, aids are certified to local governments September of the year before, August 1 of the year before they are actually paid. And so local governments were told how much they were going to get in local government aid and county program aid back in August 1, 2010. Their actual payments will start July 15th of 2011, so in the fiscal year 2012. The pay 2011 aids will be paid. That's another thing that's very confusing that we need to make clear. In property taxes, we talk pay years. That's because local governments are on generally are on calendar fiscal years. Their fiscal year runs from January to December. Virtually all of our state payments to them tend to fall in the second half of their budget year, which is our next fiscal year. So pay 2011 aids are paid in state fiscal year 2012. As you notice, LGA was kind of at a high watermark in pay 2003, $586 million. That year we didn't actually pay that amount. We paid $565 million. And then for the next 2 years after that, we lowered the appropriation. Generally, you see cuts when we make, you see a difference between certification and paid if we're going to make a cut in the current paid year. So if we're going to make a cut into a future year, generally that's handled by changing the appropriation amount for the aid program. So as you can see, the appropriations for 2004-2005 were reduced, and then they went back up in 2006 and 2007. They were supposed to remain at about that same amount in 2008, but there was a post-certification cut again in 2008. There was a post-certification cut in 2009. There were two post-certification cuts in 2010. One was the what the governor had proposed as an unallotment in January of 2010, which was later overturned by the courts, but then ratified by the legislature in the first special session of 2010. And then there was a supplemental cut that was actually made during the regular session when we still thought the unallotments were going to be legal. The total cuts to all local governments in 2010 were about $300 million. This is the local government share of it. Only about half of cities, well, I shouldn't say most cities, but about half of the population in the state of Minnesota lives in cities that don't get local, lives places that don't get local government aid. When there is no local government aid to take from a city or not enough to meet the cut, then the cuts are made out of market value credit. Go ahead. This shows what has happened in the city market value credit cuts during that period. And as you notice, 2007 is the only year that all cities have gotten every bit of market value credit that we have promised them. Market value credit is calculated slightly differently than LGA. It has an open and standing appropriation. It's calculated by formula and then spread among local governments because it's really calculated on a an individual house basis. And so the only way to carry, to reduce that program absent of changing the formulas for calculating it is to just always have a permanent offset. So as you notice, there was a cut in 2003. It was the same as the LGA cut that same year. And then we reduced the appropriation for LGA to carry the cuts forward to the cities that didn't have LGA but had market value credit. We had to just continue to carry those same cuts forward, and that's what you see on this slide.
Ms. Dalton?
County program aid is a little different than city LGA. County program aid is actually paid to all counties. There are no counties that don't get it. So generally speaking, virtually all of the cuts that have been made due to budget crisis has occurred in the county aids, not in the county market share of market value credit reimbursements. So you will see a pattern similar to what you saw in the cities. There was a big cut in 2003, a big reduction in the payment in the appropriation in 2004. It goes back up, and then beginning in 2008, 2009, and 2010, you're again seeing cuts from the certified amount.
Yes, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mrs. Dalton, I'm curious, with LGA was to help cities with their public safety issues. Curious as to the county program, what was the impetus for that funds allocated to the counties?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I think that might be better covered next meeting. We're going to actually talk about kind of the history. But county program aid is also a general purpose aid like city LGA. It has a portion of it that's spread based on some measures of need that include some factors related to crime statistics, related to poverty, related to population, and then it has a second part that is tax-based equalization.
Mr. McDonald?
Madam Chairman, Mrs. Dalton, thank you.
The one thing I wanted to point out about county market value credit is, unlike the city credit, there's only one year that we actually have cuts in the county market value credit, and that is last year. As I said, generally speaking, when a cut is made post-certification, we make the cut out of aids first, and we only take it out of credits if a city or county does not have enough money in its aid payment to cover the entire reduction. Counties have always had it. So the only reason we have a cut in 2010 is that we reversed that process for the supplemental cuts in 2010. The governor's unallotment did the normal method of first take it out of aids and then take it out of market value credit. The supplemental cuts that were covered in, that were included in Chapter 215 of last year's first reduction bill, said take the money first out of market value credit and then take it out of aids. So it was a legislative decision. I'm really not sure I could justify it, but that's why you see that cut. However, those cuts in market value credit that were related to that supplemental cut, they were not made permanent. The cuts related to the governor's unallotment to market value credit were made permanent last year. Madam Chair, we're going to skip the rest of the county, the local government aid slides, the county program aid slides, and the market value credit, and we'll just go straight to the market value credit. And we will cover the other two programs next week.
We're skipping forward to page 31, or slide 31.
So, Madam Chair, the
Mr. Hines.
So on slide 31, and again, this then would be page 26 of the longer document. The market value credit has been around since the same 2001 that I referenced as a number of these other elements of our fundamental elements of the system being put in place. And it hasn't changed at all since then, which is sort of surprising for those of us who work in property taxes that mostly these programs tend to get modified over time. The Homestead Market Value Credit provides a credit based strictly on the value of the home, and it's kind of unusual maybe in some ways in that it increases up to the value of $76,000 of the home, and that as the maximum credit is reached at $304 at $76,000, and then anything above $76,000, as the value goes up, the amount of credit goes down. It actually runs out at a value of about just over $400,000. You can see on the slide the amounts at $100,000 is $280, at $200,000 is $190. So it becomes increasingly less important as a part of the overall property tax burden as the value of the home gets greater and the credit gets smaller. The total amount of the credit is large. It was $279 million for calendar 2010, and this is really the amount that we don't exactly have a term for this, but the amount that you would determine by adding up the amount of credit that showed up on all the tax statements it was $279 million. Now the state didn't actually fully compensate the jurisdictions for all that amount, as Ms. Dalton's was just speaking about. So there's sort of two different numbers you can get when you look at the amount of market value homestead credit. One is the amount that showed up on all the statements, and the second is the amount that the state actually paid back to jurisdictions. And when things are good, those two numbers are the same. When budget's a little tight, sometimes those are not the same numbers. The ag credit works somewhat similarly in that it reaches its highest value at a market value of only $115,000. In the credit there is $345,000 as the land is you get more land above 115, the value of the credit goes down. Although with the homestead credit, the amount goes all the way down to zero. For the agricultural credit, the lowest it goes to is $230. So this chart shows $350,000 worth of land gets a $230 credit. Any amount of land above 350 would also get that $230 credit. The state cost of this credit, the ag credit, is only about $24 million per year. Sure. Now what we're going to talk next about PTR and Joel will take that.
Normally this Michael. Would be, Madam Chair, members of the division, normally this would be covered by Ms. Baker, who's out, or Ms. Manzi, who's working on some stuff for the full committee hearing. So I'll cover it. Property tax refund, it's important. This is another homeowner and renter relief program. Important to think about. Steve just talked about the market value credit, which is purely a function of the value of the home and is actually paid to the local government when it is paid and shows up as a deduction on the property tax statement. The difference with the property tax refund is it is something that the homeowner or the renter has to apply for, so it doesn't show up on the statement. And rather than being a function of the value of the home, it's a function of property taxes and the income of the claimant. So it's targeted essentially based on income and tax rather than on the market value of the home, to contrast it with the market value credit. And basically there's a formula that's written in the statute that says, first of all, when your taxes exceed a percentage of your household income, then the state will pay you a percentage of that amount over that threshold up to a maximum.
What is that threshold?
We'll get to that.
Oh.
Well, basically the threshold is a percentage of your income that varies with how high your income is. So it ranges, it's actually at the very low end, and those thresholds vary between renters and homeowners. At the very low end, it's under 1%, if I recall correctly. It's under 1% of your household income. As your income rises, it rises to 3.5% at the top end of the income threshold, of the income scale for those that qualify. This next slide breaks down the property tax refund totals by filer type and by program. So you can see, and there are special rules that apply to senior and disabled homeowners. Basically, they are allowed a deduction from their income for their status as being either seniors or disabled, that because it's a function of their income, gives them slightly larger refunds as a result. And so you can see the total cost of the program was about $450 million for the refunds that were filed in 2009. And the breakdown on the slide of those amounts among the different claimant categories. So there are, $140 million went to senior and disabled homeowners. The non-senior and disabled got $221 million and so forth. Basically, the eligibility for
this. Yes, we'll have a question. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Michael.
Michael. Just clarify something for me, please. In this tax refund, now, the property tax is paid to the local government units, the school board, the counties, and the state, city. Are these funds, are these dollars coming from the state then? Because they're certainly not given back by the local government units. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, that's correct. Basically, and that's a key distinction between the market value credit, where the state is directly reimbursing the local governments. Instead, these individual claimants in order to get the relief, pay the tax to the county, and then they apply to the state on a form that's sort of similar to an income tax form. And then the state sends them a check or directly deposits it in their bank account if that's what they ask for. So it's basically a payment directly from the state to the individual homeowner or the renter that occurs for homeowners. It generally occurs in September of the taxes payable year, and for renters it occurs in August of the year after the year in which they paid the rent. And so the local governments really aren't involved at all in this process. And then it's very clear to the claimants where the money is coming from. And if the state doesn't pay the full amount, they know who's responsible. It's not the local government, but it's the state that's involved. Now, there have been proposals over the years to try to move this, refund program directly onto the tax statement, because you can imagine it's sort of not very popular to make them pay and then apply for a refund, and it's sort of inefficient. But the difficulty with doing that is, as I indicated before, the program is a function of both your taxes and your income, and local assessors don't know the income of the claimants, and in general, because of the privacy issues involved with income, that's not something that would be easy to give local assessors access to, and they don't really want access to what every homeowner's income is. The property tax records are open, sort of open to the public, so you can come in and see what all the values and the taxes are, what all the information that's on assessment cards and so forth. By contrast, income data at the Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service is all, of course, private. You can't find any of that out. And so that's the barrier to actually, providing this refund directly on the bill, on the property tax bill, rather than having the individual apply for it.
Representative McDonald?
Madam Chairman, thank you. So in a way, you could say that the local authorities get LGA in a roundabout way when that property tax is given back to the renter or the homeowner. And then if I may follow that up with another question, regards to the same thing, regards to the commercial, industrial, seasonal, recreational, if their businesses are doing poorly, there's no benefit for them, there's no tax relief, property tax relief for them as there is for residential. So in a way, they're not treated equally as those are in a residential. I'm curious if there's ever been proposals of that to the state legislatures, that based upon commercial and seasonal recreational's income or their lack of business due to the downturn in the economy, has there ever been a proposal for a property tax refund to them?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, to address your two questions in order. First, I think an economist certainly would say that, yes, when you give a property tax refund to individuals, in effect that functions sort of as implicit aid to the local government, because it can enable them to actually levy higher taxes, because they can tell their homeowners, well, you'll know you will get back some fraction of this from the state. And in fact, there were studies that were done, and these programs are common in both, in other states as well as Minnesota. And, I recall a study that was done. Michigan has a program that's very similar to Minnesota's, even more generous than Minnesota's. And there were studies done back in the 80s, empirical studies, that shows there's an actual relationship between levying behavior by local governments and the availability of this program. And you can understand there are some communities where more taxpayers qualify for these programs because their incomes on average are lower, and the tax rates might be higher because the tax base is lower. And these economists that did this study found that levying behavior in communities where more taxpayers qualify for this program is actually higher, in part because likely the local officials recognize that, hey, some of that burden gets shifted to the rest of state taxpayers. That's probably also true of another program that typically is not thought of as a property tax relief program, but essentially sort of functions the same way, and that's the federal and state itemized deduction on income taxes for property taxes. You can imagine there are some communities that have a lot of homeowners where they know virtually everybody's an itemizer and will be able to deduct their property tax. And so when we raise property taxes, their federal and state income taxes will go down as a result, and so that may in fact have that same kind of effect. To address your second question, which is, has a similar program to this ever been looked at for either seasonal rec / cabin owners or for commercial properties? And the answer to that is no, there hasn't been. There was a time, we'll get to the targeting program in a little bit, there was a couple of years where the targeting program, which also provides a state-paid refund, applied to cabin owners. So if you had a large increase in your seasonal rec property taxes, you could get a refund of part of that back from the state as a way to sort of cushion people who had big increases in a one-year period of time.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, on the case, though, of a CI property, and maybe that's, it wouldn't apply to seasonal recreational, I don't think, unless it was a resort. But since their value is in part income capitalization, it's based on the rents. If you owned an office building and it was, 30% vacant, there's a lot of vacant property right now that's on the market right now. Wouldn't that ultimately, even though there's a lag, affect their valuation and therefore their taxes would tend to drop? It's just a lagged relief that reflects the changing economic situation.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, now you're sort of getting out of my area of expertise when you get into property tax assessment and valuation. But yes, there is a correlation between rents and valuations. It's not a correlation, I think, that's applied on an individual property basis, but more it's jurisdiction or area-wide. So assessors tend to look when rents go down, values go down. But if a specific building, a building owner experiences the difficulty that one of its tenants decides to, build a new building or move to some other place, that doesn't necessarily get, I think, reflected in the value of that building either immediately or in the long run, except to the extent it affects rents in the general area. But you'd be much better off having an assessor who knows about valuation techniques talking about that than me.
Representative Loeffler?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
If we look at this slide, this will show you the income limits that apply. So for homeowners, the maximum income is about $100,000, and the maximum refund is about $2,400 for the refunds that are being filed this year. Now, the measure of household income is a very broad measure that's much broader than the income that you think of with regard to the individual income tax. The sort of the convenient way to think about this is that it's essentially the total gross income that you report on your income tax return plus any other money income that the person receives. So things like non-taxable Social Security benefits, other non-taxable pensions, disability payments, and so forth are added. In addition, you're not allowed the deduction for voluntary contributions to retirement plans. So, for example, if you opt to contribute more to your 401k or a traditional IRA, those amounts get added back. So this is a very broad measure of income. There are deductions for dependents, though, so that is one, and that's to provide a family size adjustment in the measure of household income. For renters, obviously we don't know what the property taxes are that renters pay. The program assumes that 19% of the rent that's paid constitutes their property taxes. For last year, that was reduced to 15%. Statewide studies by the Revenue Department show that the 15% number is sort of closer to what typical property taxes for rental properties in Minnesota are, where rent is the property tax is a proportion of rent. The maximum household income for renters is quite a bit lower than for homeowners. It's about $53,000 again for this year, and the maximum refund is a little over $1,500. The special property tax refund, which is usually referred to around here as targeting, is a program that's designed to provide, again, state-paid tax refunds. It's administered as part of the property tax refund program to homeowners who have large tax increases, and the threshold for that qualifying is that you have to have at least a 12% increase, then it has to also exceed $100. Household income is not a factor under this program, so you can have very high income and still qualify. In 2009, about $6 million was paid out in refunds to over 41,000 claimants, with an average refund of $146.
Madam. Yeah, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much. Now that we're done with the aids and credits and refunds, I've got a comment and then a question on the process here. But first of all, to Representative McDonald, during these tough economic times, businesses have suffered, but so have homeowners. And this property tax refund program does not make up for that. In fact, if you look at just property taxes on homeowners, is 7 to 8 times higher than all of your property tax refunds combined. So, you know, those refunds only cover a small portion of your property taxes. You know, so to insinuate that any increase is covered by this property tax refund is false. There's a copay also. But, you know, you talk to senior citizens on fixed incomes, and in the last 8 years, property taxes on just homeowners have gone up 85%. They've been suffering with a burden for 8 years. And if you are a family and a spouse loses a job, your property taxes stay the same. Your income is down. Your property taxes out of pocket is going to go up immensely. So businesses have suffered. So have homeowners. And so I just wanted to make that point. But for you, Madam Chairperson, you know, we've talked a lot about the AIDS credits and refunds now, and almost every member here at the table in the introductions talked about the concern for keeping property taxes down. So my question is, two bills were introduced yesterday, House File 129 and House File 130. And in fact, we're hearing House File 129 and taxes right after this meeting. That bill has substantial cuts in AIDS credits and refunds, all those things we've just talked about, that has the potential to raise property taxes by $200 million a year. And so my question is, are we going to hear that bill here in this division?
Representative Marquardt, no, I believe it's only in the division here coming up. We will have a full hearing, of course, and have all of our input and all of our questions, but no, it's in the 10 o'clock taxes meeting.
Madam Chair, so you're saying that House File 129 will not be heard in division? Is that what at any time?
That's right, Representative Marquardt. Right.
Uh-huh. Well, Madam Chair, that
let me just say, I think that in part because, you know, this was a package of cuts that actually were passed last year in the House, and so it's been a discussion that's been had, it's been voted on, and I think all the members from last year did vote. So pretty similar to what was happening last year. But
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I mean, this, Madam Chair, this really, really concerns me. First of all, last year's law was temporary. These are permanent. We have several new members on this committee. This is the property tax division, and there are several members here that are not on the tax committee. And for this committee, which deals with property taxes, when I think you're looking at 227, probably about $270 to $280 million a year, over half a billion over a biennium, impacting what we just covered here, AIDS credits and refunds, I find that very disturbing that we are not going to be hearing that in this committee. So these members who just an hour ago said their major concern was rising property taxes are not going to have a voice in the property tax division to talk about that bill. And I just think this is heading down a very dangerous road as far as being able to hear the repercussions of these policies that are going to have an impact in every one of these districts on every one of these members that sit around this table. And I think a bill like this would be an excellent time to be able to talk about these things and how it's going to affect these communities. And I guess I don't know what other members are thinking here on this division, but House File 129 is a bill we should be hearing here.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I just want to back up Representative Marquardt on this. And I certainly understand everyone has to figure out how they want to do things, and a new majority has the opportunity and the decision-making ability to make that decision. But, you know, I just on a very personal level would really urge you to try to get Representative Davids to change his mind on that. And I'm fortunate that I serve on both committees. But I'll tell you, since I've been here, I've never seen property tax sweeping changes not go to the property tax committee. I think if this was the health committee deciding to cut LG aid and county aid and refunds, people would sort of get immediately why that wouldn't be a good idea. And that this is the committee that should have the input to the full tax committee to decide what to do. And, the public really views the property tax committee as the committee where they can come and tell us, that they're concerned about their property taxes going up. The businesses can tell us. In preparing for the next committee, I was looking through the revenue estimate, and to see these numbers, LGA means $143 million a year, the county program made $85 million a year. We have to cut, and you're right, Madam Chair. We did take votes to cut these things last year. I voted for them. I actually am one of the very few members who voted to make the cuts permanent with the governor. And so I certainly, you're right. I think everybody who was in the House last year did have the full debate, but we have 30-something new members. I see this committee as full of not only new members to the legislature, but new members to this committee. Representative Mahoney, for example, who's came in with me, is new to the property tax committee this year. And so I think, I do think members, should really fight for the purview. And I guess I would sort of pile on, not on that bill, but just to say that in listening to the school items, I would hope that you in the future would really push your colleagues to fight to make sure that you can keep the purview of this committee as the chair of this committee in a couple specific areas. There's been a number of bills introduced that have tax impacts for you that have been sent to other committees, and I've been following them on introduction. Some are in the Veterans Committee, Health Committee, wherever. And I hope you'll fight to get them back here because they're tax changes. Additionally, the school, former Republican tax chairs, Representative Abrams and Krinke, and I did the same, and the division chairs have done the same, made sure the school finance bills came through your committee and full tax committee because they are property tax changes, as we've absolutely just heard. They have huge impacts.
Right.
The transportation bills have huge tax impacts. And so, we're really all kind of bipartisanly relying on chairs to fight for their purviews. So, maybe you can have a conversation with Representative Davids. I do think it is a little strange to not have a major property tax change come through your committee. And I don't know how you personally feel about it, but we'd support you in fighting to send it here when we get to the next tax committee. So
yeah, and point well taken, and appreciate your input there, Representative Lencheski. I do believe it had to do more with the fact that, this is ground that was covered in a previous year. It may be that some of the new members, it's old business in a sense, and so that is my understanding. But I'll certainly have future conversations with Representative Davids, and you have my, my promise that we'll get these bills here in this committee.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney was next, or Benson. I'm sorry, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm a new member of this committee as well, and Representative Abrams, who had been chair of the tax committee before I served in the same House seat as he, was some of the actions taken in that tax committee was a motivation for me to run for office. And I asked to be on this committee because I considered it an extremely important issue, considering the funding problems that state has. And I'm just surprised that I gave up a position on K-12 finance, my request to be on it at least, in order to serve on this committee. And it sounds as if we're in irrelevancy. So I'm just curious to wonder why I should be on this committee.
Representative Benson, I can assure you we are going to have a full-throated hearing on every issue related to property taxes that is going to come before this committee. And all ideas are welcome. We want a bipartisan bill because I don't think property taxes is partisan. It's got to be something we all care about. So I can assure you that's the way it's going to be.
Madam Chair, we're having this particular bill, House File 129, having a direct impact on property taxes. I just fail to understand, maybe it's because I'm new to the committee, why a committee on property tax would not hear such a bill.
Representative Benson,
what is
Benson,
the reason I don't comprehend it?
You know, we'll probably talk about it at 10 o'clock. I think it was a leadership decision, a Chair David's decision, and we'll probably get more in the next committee. So, Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm one of the nine members on this committee that's never served on property taxes. And you know, I think I had my second visit to the tax committee in 12 years yesterday. And, you know, there was no blood. So I thought that was pretty good. But here's my problem. You know, I've been paying property taxes for going on almost 40 years now. I've been voting on property tax reductions and increases and machinations of it for the last 12. I came to this committee to try to understand more about property taxes because it certainly affects my city, and if LGA continues to get cut, it's going to be an even larger issue for my city and my constituents. So, you know, I'm not trying to beat anybody up here. I certainly hope that, you know, $500 million over a biennium, you bring that to this committee. But barring that, you've got nine members, more so on your side of the aisle than on our side of the aisle. It's incumbent upon the chair to help us to start to understand what these credits and aids are. So if this doesn't come to our committee, what's your suggestion about learning about this stuff? Because this really will become a tutorial in aids and credits. And if we don't hear it, I don't get to learn it.
Well, one thing, I mean, you ask what we might do, and I'm certainly willing to, if there are members of the committee that are interested in putting in additional time on this subject matter, this session, I'm more than willing to devote some time, and so, you know, let me know. And if it can be bipartisan, all the better. Because I think we owe it to Minnesota to actually have a more workable system, one that is not confusing, one that is not as unique amongst states. So I'm ready to do it. And if you want to be an informal working group, you know, let our folks know, and we'll start doing that. So, Representative McDonald.
Yeah, although we're a mile down the road, I just want to clarify something that Representative Marquette said. I was referring to some commercial property tax assistance, and I never even insinuated that the cities should increase property tax on the low income or those who have their incomes were lower from the previous year. That never came from this side. It was suggested, it was mentioned over there. So I don't know if you insinuated that, but for the record, I want that to be known that I never even mentioned that cities should raise their property tax knowing that they'll get a refund back from the state. Never even came from me. If you heard that, I'm not sure how you would hear it that way, but for the record, that was not said by me.
Thank you, and I think we're wrapping up for today, so meeting adjourned.